This is Sunday Assembly, Silicon Valley's first assembly of 2016, recorded on January 10th. And now, leading the assembly is Hester Wagner.
All right, everyone, we're going to go ahead and get started, so come find a seat. Welcome, everybody, to Sunday Assembly 2016, New Year. And although a lot will change in 2016, some things never will. So we're going to start with a couple of songs. Here we go.
This is a story about Billy Joe and Bobby Sue. Two young lovers with nothing better to do. Sit around the house, get high and watch the two. And here's what happened when they decided to cut loose. They headed down to El Paso. When they got into a great big hassle, Billy Joe shot a man while robbing his castle. Bobby Sue took the money and run. Go on, take 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 the money and run. Billy Mac is a detective down in Texas. You know he knows just exactly what the facts is. He ain't gonna let those two escape justice. He makes his living off of the people's taxes. Bobby Sue, whoa, oh, she slipped away. Billy Joe caught up to the very next day. They got the money, hey, you know they got away. They're headed down south and there's no running today. Go on, take the money and run. Go on, take the money and run. Ooh, go on, take the money and run. Ooh, ah! Go on.
Audience participation aspect. There's like some haze in the song. And we have Amy here, our lovely helper, who's going to let you know when the haze are, and we'll throw our arms up and you guys can join in. And we'll all go, hey! Can you guys do that? One, two, three. Hey! Love it! Love it!
Ready?
Yep.
One, two, three, four.
Hey!
I think we can do a little bit better, yeah?
Hey!
Love it!
Well done, everyone. So welcome to Sunday Assembly, celebration of the one life we all know that we have. How many people are here today for the first time? Raise your hands up, leave them up. Somebody turn around, give them a high five. Awesome. How many people are here for the second time? Awesome. It's good to see you guys again. So happy 2016. We're going to kick off the new year by doing an icebreaker. And this is going to be, I guess, getting us all ready for March Madness in a couple months. We're going to do this tournament style. So I promise this is a talent that you all possess. We're not doing a big stretch here. We're going to do tournament style rock, paper, scissors. Okay? There is a prize. It is a jam. Homemade. Strawberry jam. So I will explain the rules, and then Caroline is going to help facilitate just to do crowd control and make sure, you know, there's no riots and chair throwing. First of all, does everybody know how to play rock, paper, scissors, or Rochambeau? We're going to go, let me start. When you start to play, you're going to go one, two, three, then throw your thing, okay? So it's going to be after three. One, two, three, throw. Okay? Everybody got that? So that will avoid any rule-breaking confusion. You're going to start, you're going to pick a partner, somebody next to you, and you're just going to go once. It's not best of three, it's just one time. So one, two, three, boom. Paper covers rock, rock smashes scissors, scissors cut paper. So that's how it goes, right? When you've decided who wins out of your partner, you're going to play the partners behind you, next to you, etc., whoever won that, and you're going to go in your little section until you have a winner of each section, and then we're going to bring the top three up here, and we're going to do a little round robin until whoever wins, there'll be one winner, and they'll get the jam. Does that make sense? Okay, so everybody find a partner. Turn to your partner. Once you've determined a winner, find the winner of somebody else. One, two, three, action. When you've lost, you can sit down. Let's have all the winners come into the front now. We're down to just a few. Winners, come to the front. All right, I guess we're down to final four. Okay, so we have this group and this group. That went fast. Okay, so should we go at the same time or one and then the other? Okay, so ready, This is, what's it called, the semifinals?
Yeah.
Okay, semifinal round, and go. So now, yes, so now we'll do best two out of three for the final round. So, yeah, who do we have?
Kayla.
Kayla. And Stephanie. All right. Okay, so best out of three, one, two, three, throw, and go. So now that you all know how to play, when we have our potluck after Sunday Assembly today, you can continue to try to best each other at Rochambeauing. All right, so today our topic is going to be evil. There you go. So we're going to explore the idea, do we see life in black or white or shades of gray? We're going to have a lot of fun stuff around that. We're going to start with our morning reading, and that's going to come from Amy Baldwin.
This is a poem called See No Evil by Billy Collins. No one expected all three of them to sit there on their tree stumps forever, their senses covered with their sinuous paws, so as to shut out the vile, nefarious world. As it happened, it was the one on the left who was the first to desert his post, uncupping his ears, then loping off into the orbit of rumors and lies, but also into the realm of symphonies, the sound of water tumbling over rocks, and the wind stirring the leafy domes of trees. Then the monkey on the right lowered his hands from his wide mouth and slipped away in search of someone to talk to, some news he could spread, or maybe something to curse or shout about. And that left the monkey in the middle, alone with his silent vigil, shielding his eyes from depravity's spectacle, blind to the man whipping his horse and the woman shaking her baby in the air, but also unable to see the russet sun on a rough shelf of rock and apples in the grass at the base of a tree. Sometimes he wonders about the other two, listens for the faint sounds of their breathing up there on the mantel alongside the clock and the candlesticks. And some nights in the quiet house, he wishes he could break the silence with a question, but he knows the one on the right would not be able to hear, and the one to his left, according to their sacred oath, the one they all took with one paw raised, is forbidden ever to speak, even in reply.
Thank you, Amy. All right, today's guest speaker is Robert Wright. Robert Wright is an author, most recently of The Evolution of God, which was a New York Times bestseller and was also a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize. His other books include The Moral Animal, which the New York Times Book Review named one of the 10 best books in 1994, and Non-Zero, which Bill Clinton called astonishing and instructed the entire White House staff members to read. In 2009, Wright was named by Foreign Policy magazine as one of the top 100 global thinkers. Wright has written for The Atlantic, The New Yorker, The New York Times Magazine, Foreign Policy, the op-ed pages of The New York Times, The Washington Post, and The Financial Times. His books have been translated into more than a dozen languages, and his awards include the National Magazine Award for Essay and Criticism. Wright is a visiting professor of science and religion at Union Theological Seminary in New York, and is an editor-in-chief of the websites bloggingheads.tv and meaningoflife.tv. Please welcome Robert Wright.
Well, thank you very much. I am going to talk about evil, and I should start by apologizing. When I chose this topic, I hadn't yet seen the guidelines they send around to speakers that Sunday Assembly sends around, and those only came to my attention a couple days ago, and I noticed that it says that the subjects of these kinds of talks should be either, quote, positive or neutral, and I think we can all agree that evil does not qualify either of those. I'm sorry about that. The good news is I'm also going to talk about something called moral imagination, which sounds a little more upbeat. And in any event, I'll try to end on a positive note. But first, I would like to wallow in evil for a while. So most of you look old enough to remember George Bush's Axis of Evil speech in 2002 about Iraq, Iran, and North Korea. I'm actually old enough to have written about it. I wrote a piece for Slate. And I was about as dismissive and snarky as you would expect from someone of my ideological persuasion. In fact, I was taken to task for this by the well-known conservative blogger, Instapundit. He called my Slate piece both snide and dumb. That's a quote. Believe it or not, that was actually not the part of his post that most offended me, because he also wrote... I think that what makes people cringe about good and evil discussions, and he was talking about me here, I think that what makes people cringe about good and evil discussions is that if you admit that good and evil exist, that creates obligations to oppose evil and to support good. That's work, and it involves responsibility. So now he was calling me not just dumb and snide, but lazy and irresponsible, and I decided that was too much. He'd gone too far, so I emailed him. And complained, and to his credit, he actually did a follow-up post saying he thought he'd been too hard on me. But anyway, what I said in the email is that when I was kind of ridiculing the notion of evil as used by George Bush, I wasn't dismissing the idea of moral bad or that there are morally wrong behaviors. I wasn't being morally relativistic. I was critiquing a conception of evil that I consider kind of the classic ancient conception of evil. And here it's the notion of some kind of like supernatural force or metaphysical substance that underlies all the bad things in the world. It is the source of all the bad. So to believe in evil in this sense isn't just to believe in bad or very, very bad. It's to have kind of a grand unified theory of badness. Okay, that's what evil means in the sense that I was taking it. There's something appealing about this idea, actually, because if you're going to combat bad things, which I think we're all in favor of, it's nice to be able to focus your energies efficiently, you know? And if there's a single source of all the bad things, then that gets a little easier. So it's like in Lord of the Rings, you know, what is it? Sauron is the source of good, and somebody will know where he lives. What's his home? Very good, good. this is... there's some houses of worship where not as many people would have known that. And that is to your credit. So in Lord of the Rings, the mission is clear. It's a hard mission, but at least it's a very clear mission. You know where to focus your energy. So I started wondering, like, well, is there such a thing as a modern, scientifically respectable conception of evil that's parallel to this? In other words, leave aside kind of supernatural forces, metaphysical substances. Is there some phenomenon, some part of psychology, some behavioral tendency that is responsible for all the bad things in the world? And I think the short answer is no, but I think we can still ask the question, well, what's the closest you could come to that? Is there one thing, one phenomenon that is responsible for more bad things than anything else in the world? In other words, is there, what's the closest we could come to a grand unified theory of bad in a scientifically respectable sense of the term? Well, my own candidate for the honor of a biggest single source of badness is the failure to put yourself in the shoes of other people. Now, by that, I don't just mean empathy in the classic kind of feel their pain sense. I do mean that. That's part of what I mean. And that's very important. Because if you don't acknowledge the significance of other people's suffering, then you're not acknowledging their moral worth as human beings. And of course, lots of bad things have been done by people who did not acknowledge the moral worth of certain people or whole groups of people. You know, history is full of these infamous figures. I will not mention any in the interest of keeping this as close to positive or neutral as possible, but you can use your imagination. So this is sometimes called emotional empathy, this kind of empathy. There's a second sense of putting yourself in the shoes of other people that whose importance I think is underrated, sometimes called cognitive empathy. And this just refers to kind of understanding how the world looks from someone's point of view, whether or not you sympathize with them or identify with them, or at least understanding how things look. This is sometimes called perspective taking. Now, moral imagination is a term that's been used in various different ways. When I use it, what I mean is putting yourself in other people's shoes in cases where that's particularly challenging and hard to do. It may be hard to do because they're in very different circumstances from yours, a different culture, a nation, a socioeconomic demographic. It may be hard to do for other reasons that we'll come to. But I do think it's important when it's hard to do to try to exercise your moral imagination. In fact, I think it's when it's the hardest to do that the most good can come from it. Now, this brings us back to the axis of evil, and in particular, Saddam Hussein, who led the Iraqi regime and was therefore part of Bush's axis of evil. Now, in the run-up to the war, I don't recall a lot of people saying, "Hey, guys, could we just look at things from Saddam Hussein's point of view?" That just wasn't a very popular thing to say. And yet, I actually think that some good could have resulted from that. Now, as you may recall, the situation was we invaded because we thought he had weapons of mass destruction. Now, ironically, he had actually opened his country to international weapons inspectors who had been allowed to look wherever they wanted for weapons, and they hadn't found any. So you might ask, well, why did we invade? Well, part of the answer is that he did offer resistance kind of around the margins, you might say. He let the inspectors in, but, for example, when we said, well, we'd like to take your government scientists out of your country and interrogate them, he said, no, that's going too far. And we said, well, then he must have something to hide. I mean, why else would he not let us interrogate his scientists? Well, actually, if you work, you can imagine reasons. I mean, for example, maybe he didn't want to humiliate himself any further in the eyes of his people. It's kind of a common misconception about dictators that they don't worry about what their people think because they're dictators. The truth is closer to the opposite. They're very insecure because they know their rule is illegitimate. So that's one reason he might not have wanted to let scientists be interrogated. You can imagine others, but in any sense, we didn't go through the exercise. You know, we didn't just try to put ourselves in his shoes, just ask the question, why is he doing what he's doing? Partly as a result of that, we invaded, tons of people died, ISIS was unleashed, and the rest is history. So I think failing to exercise moral imagination can have bad consequences, even with your enemies. Now, why is it so hard to imagine to exercise moral imagination? Why don't we do it in these cases? Well, as I said, sometimes it's because the person in question is in very different circumstances from our own. Most of us don't have much experience being brutal dictators, so naturally we're not good at that exercise. But there are other reasons as well, and some of them have to do with what psychologists call cognitive biases. Now, cognitive biases have gotten a lot of attention lately. You've probably heard of the confirmation bias, whereby we only see evidence that's consistent with our pre-existing view, and that's an important one. There's another cognitive bias that I think deserves more attention than it's gotten and is very relevant to this whole discussion, and that is called the fundamental attribution error. And here's how it works. As originally identified by psychologists, the idea of the fundamental attribution error is that people are inclined to attribute too much of other people's behavior to their disposition, to the kind of person they are, and not enough to environmental circumstance. So, for example, if you see somebody being rude to a store clerk, you'll think, well, that's a rude person, and maybe a consistently rude person, may also just be they had a bad day. But we tend to kind of assume that whatever we see a person doing is traceable to the kind of person that is. Now, that was the original idea of the fundamental attribution error. And since then, it's acquired some nuance. They've discovered that really whether you commit this error depends on your relationship to the people you're observing and what they're doing. And this is a really important finding, I think, and hasn't gotten as much attention as it deserves. The basic idea is this. With your friends and allies, if they do something good, you attribute that to their disposition. That's the kind of people they are. They're good people. Okay? If they do something bad, then you have a circumstantial explanation. It was peer pressure or something. With your enemies and rivals, it's the opposite. If they do something bad, you say, well, yeah, of course they did something bad. They're bad people. If they do something good, you explain it away. They're just showing off or something like that. So now I think maybe you can see the relevance of all this to Saddam Hussein. I mean, he had been defined pretty clearly as an enemy. And so when he did things like refuse to let us interrogate his scientists, we didn't look real hard for some kind of, what is the circumstantial reason that he might do this? We just said, yeah, he's a bad guy. He does bad things. This is par for the course. It reinforces our pre-existing conception of him. Now, why had he been defined as the enemy? Well, partly because he was. He had done things inimical to American interests, other countries, and moreover, he's a really bad guy. He was definitely a bad guy. At the same time, people who favored the war had gone to great lengths to paint him in the darkest terms possible by using phrases like axis of evil. And you can see why people who are in favor of a war would go to great pains to demonize the leader of the nation they want to invade as much as possible. This makes total sense in light of this fundamental attribution error, right? Because once America is thinking of these people as the enemy, then they're in a box they can't get out of. Anything bad they do will just reinforce the enemy image, and anything good they do will be explained away as they're cynically responding to a particular kind of pressure, or they're doing this or they're doing that, but it won't change our fundamental image of them. So the fundamental attribution error helps explain the kind of strategy of the psychology leading up to war. So that's kind of my theory of evil. I mean, if I had to pick one thing that's most responsible for bad things in the world, it would be this failure to put yourself in the shoes of other people. I don't have time to elaborate, I think it has massively bad consequences. I think if you look at one of the biggest problems in the world now, which I would say is tribalism, you know, sectarian tribalism, Sunni Shia nationalistic tribalism, Russia versus Ukraine or versus the West, or even ideological tribalism within America, where political disagreements are getting more and more bitter, and contention along ethnic lines and so on seems to me to be getting worse and worse. I think a lot of the psychology of tribalism boils down to this difficulty we have putting ourselves in the shoes of other people. So if I had to use the word evil, that is the way I would use the word evil. On the other hand, I would really just rather not use the word evil at all. And the reason is, the way it's commonly understood, what it means is just incomprehensibly bad. This person is incomprehensibly bad. And if you think that, then you're not going to do the work of putting yourself in their shoes and looking at the way things look from their point of view, because it doesn't matter. They're just bad. So in a way, evil as it's commonly understood is just an excuse not to exercise your moral imagination. So you might say that evil as it's commonly understood is evil in my sense of the term evil. But since I'm pretty sure I'm not going to get convinced the world to use evil, in my sense of the word evil, I'd rather just drop the word altogether. So I encourage you all to go through the rest of your lives without ever uttering the word. Now, so what do we do about this problem? The difficulty we all have with moral imagination. I should say, by the way, I know this is sounding like a sermon, and at this point I should confess that I was brought up a Southern Baptist. which explains not only why it's a sermon, but why it's kind of a dark sermon. Sorry about that. But I don't mean to sound that I'm like holier than thou or holier than George Bush. Because the fact is, we all have our Saddam Husseins. We all have people, rivals, enemies that we have tremendous trouble extending moral imagination to. And in fact, for me, some of the people I have most trouble extending moral imagination to are the people who got us into the Iraq War. So like the George Bushes and Dick Cheneys of the world, it just seems to me I take every opportunity to think the worst of them. Now, it seems to me that they're making that easy for me, but of course that's what I would think, right? Because I've got these cognitive biases that I'm viewing the world through. So I try to dismiss that possibility. There's a reason that these cognitive biases are so hard to overcome. They seem to have been engineered into the brain by natural selection, deeply engineered. According to evolutionary psychology, many of these biases were kind of built into us to kind of help our ancestors navigate a landscape of enemies and allies in the context of a hunter-gatherer society, which, of course, is very different from the environment we're in today, but unfortunately, we seem to be stuck with them. But we can resist them. And I think the first step toward that is just awareness, being aware of our cognitive biases. That by itself isn't a miracle cure. And for me, what I would say limited progress I've made, and it's limited and erratic and there is backsliding, but with limited progress I've made in fighting these kinds of cognitive biases has to do with what you might call a spiritual discipline. So I meditate every day. I go to meditation retreats and so on. And I do think that has helped me on balance to get a little better at expanding my moral imagination. There are lots of other approaches you could use aside from meditation. I mean, there are therapies, there are self-help books, there are various kinds of reflections you could do. I would say that by my lights, any technique you use to expand your moral imagination does, in a sense, qualify as a spiritual discipline. And the reason I say that has to do with my conception of what spirituality is. You know, a lot of people these days say that they're spiritual but not religious. If you ask what they mean by that, you get a variety of answers as to what spiritual means to them. They may say they think of the universe as sacred, or they have feelings of awe and wonder in the presence of nature or love or whatever. And I think all these are legitimate parts of a spiritual worldview. But one way I think of what spirituality is to look at one theme that I think you can find in all the great spiritual traditions. It's this idea that our ordinary consciousness, our ordinary way of looking at the world is actually deeply misleading. We're really not seeing the whole truth. There's something we're missing. And that by kind of penetrating the veil of delusion, we can not only align ourselves more closely with the truth, but align our behavior more closely with moral truth. And that's why I say that any discipline that helps you see other people more clearly, notwithstanding the difficulty of doing that sometimes, in that sense at least, qualifies as a spiritual discipline. Now, having subjected you to basically a disguised version of a Southern Baptist sermon about our sinful nature, I do, as promised, want to close with a little good news. First of all, I think exercising moral imagination will not only make you behave better in a more morally defensible way, I think it will also make your life better. You'll have fewer pointless arguments with your spouse or your partner or whoever you're most inclined to have pointless arguments with. Your collaborative relationships in your professional life will, I think, go better and on and on. And I think there's a more kind of profound benefit. You know, when I'm at the end of a, like, one-week meditation retreat, that's when, like, my moral imagination is at its optimal, because some backsliding, sadly, is inevitable after that, and the most I can hope to do is minimize the backsliding through a daily meditation practice. But when I get to that point, you know, and there's been a real kind of release from the kinds of antagonisms and enmities that energize our cognitive biases and that constrain our moral imagination, it's a really deeply great feeling. You know, it's a feeling as if, you know, as one noted spiritual leader said, the truth will set you free. Does anybody know which spiritual leader said that? Actually, I think Jesus said it. St. Paul may have said it. Jesus said it in a parable. St. Paul repeated much of what Jesus said, so he may have. In any event, the Southern Baptist in me applauds your answer as well as mine. So finally, quick word in defense of natural selection. I've been hard on natural selection, kind of, because it you know, built these cognitive biases into us. It leads us to deploy our empathy in a kind of less than morally optimal way, you might say. On the other hand, it did give us the empathy in the first place, the capacity for empathy. It gave us love and so on. And you might not expect that. If somebody just described to you this dog-eat-dog, survival of the fittest, creative process, you might not guess that these things would grow out of it. It has also given us rational minds that can reflect on our cognitive biases and try to improve our behavior. And these rational minds have also now given rise to a process of intellectual discovery called science, which is now starting to provide further guidance, you know, about these cognitive biases and how to try to overcome them. So science is now really enriching and informing what I would call a spiritual discipline. I would call it that, at least, and that's good news. So, yes, natural selection left us with some baggage, but I would say that, you know, things could be worse. And that is my uplifting message to you. Things could be worse.
We have a gift for you, Robert. Thank you very, very much. I will tell you guys right now, my New Year's resolution this year is to be more positive. I've decided poo-poo with the gym and all that stuff. I'm just going to try to look on the bright side of things. So things could be worse. It's a great way to start. Just to let you guys know, Robert does need to leave pretty quickly after, so he's not going to necessarily be around to chat. But we have a clipboard we're going to pass around, and if you are interested in continuing this discussion or, you know, further elaborating in a smaller environment with Robert about this, there is a Google Hangout possibility. So we'll get that information and figure all that technological stuff out so that that can continue later. Yeah, if you are interested in continuing, put your email down and we will mash all that up. Right? I said that right? Awesome. Cool. So during our next song, which is going to be a performance song, we are going to be passing our little hat box around for... I can't see that far. I'm getting old. We'll be passing our donation box around. You might notice that some people are just dropping cards into that box. That means that they are a sustaining donor and that they're donating monthly. All of our board members are monthly donors, and many other of you as well. If you're interested in signing up for a recurring membership, you can do that on our website. If you're interested in making a donation today by credit card, you can hold up your hand and we'll bring you the swipey reader thing. And now, welcome Rich Thomas for Cruel to Be Kind, continuing our theme.
Can't take another heartache. So you say you're my friend, I'm at my wit's end. You say your love is bona fide, but that don't coincide with the things that you do. When I ask you to be nice, you say you gotta be cool to be kind in the right measure. Well, I do my best to understand, dear, but you're still mystified. I wanna know why I pick myself up off the ground, leave you knocking down again and again. When I ask you to explain, you say you gotta be cruel to be kind in the right measure. Cruel to be kind, it's a very good sign. Cruel to be kind means that I love you, baby. You gotta be cruel, you gotta be cruel to be kind. Well, I do my best to understand, dear, but you're still mystified. I wanna know why I pick myself up off the ground and have you drag me down again and again. When I ask you to explain, you say you gotta be cruel to me.
Thank you, guys. Awesome. Our next segment today is called Doing Your Best. It's when a member of our community takes the mic to tell us about a moment when they tried to live better, help often, or wonder more. Today's story comes from Laura Green. Please welcome Laura.
While looking at holiday light displays with extended family, we came upon a house with just one decoration, a glowing blue string of lights outlining the shape of a large cross. As my Mormon family members began to discuss with the children that Jesus died for their sins, my own 5-year-old son, Oliver, approached. With unbridled enthusiasm, he exclaimed, "Mommy, this one looks like the Tron movie, T for Tron." This gave me a serious case of the warm fuzzies, despite my family's disapproving looks. And to be fair, Tron risked his life to save his friends, so the stories are essentially the same. As a secular parent, I have experienced my fair share of religious concern for the way my husband and I are raising our family. To me, the idea that we can instill moral values in our children without the concepts of deities, heaven, and hell is not even remotely in dispute. Yet I struggle with the feeling that I somehow have to prove to the majority that I belong and have a voice in the moral sphere. I strive to set a good example, with perhaps wishful thinking that this will in some small way influence the perception of what it means to be good. But when dealing with those practiced in the art of confirmation bias, I often feel like my normal mistakes and issues are held under a microscope, while my successes receive very little attention. When I was a young girl and asked one of my many, many questions, such as how dinosaurs fit into the story of the world being created in 7 days, I unfailingly watched adults become visibly uncomfortable and struggle to tell me something that would appease me and shut me up, something about faith and mysterious ways. I have vowed as an adult to never do my own children such a disservice. Questions are doorways, and I will always seek to give answers that open rather than close those doors. It is a wonderful thing to be free of dogma and free to say, "I don't know. Let's look it up and give it some thought." That, to me, is the best inoculation I can give my children against a confusing and sometimes frightening world. Complete freedom to question and wonder without any judgment from me. In the everyday chaos of raising small children, I try to stay strong and remember that I don't need anyone's approval but my own. I know what is important to me: kindness, courage, compassion, curiosity. And I know I am imparting these principles to my children in the hope that they will be the next generation to show the world what it means to be good. That is how I'm doing my best.
Thank you, Laura. That was wonderful and inspiring. And now we have 2 minutes to think about everything that we've learned today. So you can reflect, have a moment of calm. Rich is going to play us some music, and I'll let you know when 2 minutes is up. All right, so starting at the beginning of last year, we started collecting what we've been calling member milestones. And if you guys stick around for the potluck afterwards, or you may have seen them as you came in, we put all of 2015's out on the tables for folks to look at. And one of the things that came up today as we were setting them out is that there's a lot of positive stuff, you know, things that people achieved or new things that have gone in there. But there's also a lot of cards that represent struggles that we went through in 2015. And we decided that it's important to honor all of that, both the positive and the hardships that we went through. So they're all out there for you guys to look at. And now that it's 2016, we're going to start our jar again, start filling it up for this year. And I think maybe a more apt name for it we discussed is the Life Happens Jar. So that can kind of encompass the entirety of our human experience. So for January, we have Paul was accepted into the New Leaders Council, an organization that trains young progressives to become leaders in their community. Sorry. This one says, "This week I'm stepping into my fear of leading and past the little but persistent voice inside that doubts I have value to add to the world. Yikes and yay, Raji." Richard's son was admitted into the University of Chicago. Ooh, yum. Serena's Girl Scout troop will be selling cookies to fundraise for a service trip to Belize. Look for cookies at the February 14th assembly. Absolutely. Bin mints. Over the holidays, I made it to my 7th continent. After 8.5 years of homeschooling, my son started charter school this month, and that's Denise in her voice. So let's continue to share in our stories of our lives as we move forward, and then we'll display them again at the end of this year. All right, so one special announcement today. Lindsay, in the back over there, has retired as our hospitality coordinator. So a very big thanks to her and to Chris for 2 years of bringing us tea, coffee, and cake. Thank you very, very much, and congratulations on your next step of your journey. All right, so we have some other quick announcements. First, Paul's going to tell us about community service and volunteering.
Great. So I just want to start, as I typically do now, with all the people who have volunteered before in some capacity to please stand up with Sunday Assembly. And let's just give them a quick round of applause. Thank you to all of you. Again, my goal is to have all of you stand up, so I'm going to try to create as many opportunities for that as possible. For this month, on the 23rd, we're doing an event with Garden to Table from 9 a.m. or 9:30 a.m. to 12:30 p.m. If you're interested, you can go ahead and see me after, or you can sign up on Meetup or through email. Any of those work? There's also a blood drive that's happening the same day that's being organized by the Atheist Community of San Jose. So if you're interested, I can provide you more information on that. That's not something that we're taking point on, but if you would like to participate. And that's sort of throughout the afternoon, so there's plenty of time if you wanted to do both. And that's it for now. Okay.
You can continue to check back on the website and on the Meetup for more opportunities and sign up so that Paul can email you about things, etc. We had a really, really awesome winter solstice celebration back in December, so thank you to everybody who came out to that, worked hard on putting it together, making it awesome. We would love feedback on that event, so if you attended and you would like to see it happen again and what we can do better, there is a very, very short feedback form on the website, so please go and give us that so we can incorporate those things into next year. Raji and Haley have found a spot at the Palo Alto Quaker Meeting House for tomorrow's Compassionate Listening Group, and there's information on the slide for that, and you can check Meetup for more information. You may have noticed that Steve Sargent is recording the assemblies from now on as a podcast. We'll have that available to download, and you can listen to our speakers. And, you know, if you zoned out for a minute, you can come back and re-listen to it. Or if you had a friend that wanted to come and you'd really love for them to hear what went on, they can listen to it as well. Next month's assembly, we will be kind of having a lot of things going on. It's on February 14th, Singles Appreciation Day. I think is what that's called. Valentine's Day for some of you. And Darwin Day. And we're going to have a special talk from Dr. Lynn Rothschild, who is an evolutionary biologist and astrobiologist from NASA. That sounds awesome. So thank you guys all for coming. We're going to have our one final song. And then today we do get to stay in the space for a little bit longer. So we're having a potluck. Everybody is welcome to stay, whether you brought food or not. It's totally fine. Please stay and eat. I'm sure we have plenty to go around. We've got games out on the tables. You guys can mingle and play rock, paper, scissors, etc. So we'll have our last song. Yes? Is the 14th at 10:30? It's at 10:30. Okay. Oh, right. Okay. So, yeah, same as it ever was. But get here early for the fun and the mingling. Okay.
One last one. A fun one. Yay!
it before we leave. I wrote it on the last. I'm throwing things. In January 22nd, here at the San Jose's Women Club, is LunaFest. It's a great festival of short films by, for, and about women. So if you are interested in attending that, there are postcards out on the tables when you walked in. Sunday Assembly is going to be doing the audiovisual for that, so it's a great kind of collaboration and sponsorship of this event. So please come out and attend that. I don't know what to say now. There's no paper in front of me. If you can, when you go over to the potluck, take a chair with you so we can double duty our chairs today. Come again on February 14th. Go out in the world, live better, help off and wonder more, and don't say the E word ever again. Thank you, guys.
You've been listening to Sunday Assembly Silicon Valley's first assembly of 2016, recorded on January 10th.
If you've enjoyed listening to this celebration of life and want to learn more about Sunday Assembly Silicon Valley, please check us out online at sundayassemblysv.org.
This assembly was hosted by Hester Wagner and features guest speaker Robert Wright. Also featured were Amy Baldwin and Laura Green. Performing in our band is guitarist Rich Thomas from Corduroy Jim, percussionist Roberto Hernandez from Robanzo's Bolero, singer Caroline Clark, and of course, our assemblers. The assembly was produced by Jillian Klaus,
with recording engineering by Steve Sargent of Effable Communications. Find us on Twitter at SunAssembly_SV and like our Facebook page at SundayAssemblySV. As a nonprofit organization run by volunteers, we count on the support of our members to enable us to continue helping our community to live this one life we know we have as fully as possible. If you want to hear more of these podcasts, please consider making a donation at sundayassemblysv.org. If you're not in Silicon Valley, find a local assembly at sundayassembly.com.
Thank you for listening.
Remember to live better, help often, and wonder more.